As we continue our study in the book of Haggai, we're still in the second chapter, and last time we just got into the third verse. And what he's doing in this third verse is he is showing the people that this rebuilt temple is going to be inferior to the original temple. So he asks three questions in verse 3. He says, "Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing?" So these three questions are asked to cause the people to be aware that this temple is going to be inferior to the original temple. This fact caused many to be discouraged by its lack of splendor. Some of the people had seen the temple before its destruction. Haggai may have been among them. And Ezra 3:8-13 tells us that many of the older ones wept aloud when they saw the second temple because it was so inferior to the first temple. The question to ask here are directed to those individuals who survived the catastrophe of the Babylonian captivity. They're the ones now who are a part of the residue of God's people. This first temple had suffered a lot of abuse, and it may be well to look at some of the abuse that it received. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem and carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord, 1 Kings 14:25-26. When Hazael, king of Aram, attacked Jerusalem, Joash, king of Judah, took all the sacred objects dedicated by his fathers and sent them as ransom to Hazael, 2 Kings 12:17-18. The same plundering of the temple objects was done when King Ahaz made payment to the king of Assyria, 2 Kings 16:17-18. And later damage was done to the temple by Hezekiah, who redeemed Jerusalem in return for, quote, all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord, the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorpost, end of quote, 2 Kings 8:13-16. In the eighth year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, removed all the treasures from the temple of the Lord and took away all the gold articles that Solomon had made for the temple of the Lord, 2 Kings 24:12-13. So the reference in our text here could not have been to the original glory of Solomon's temple, but it must refer to the glory that is still contained even after Nebuchadnezzar carried Jehoiakim into exile in 597 B.C., Jeremiah 27:16-22. Before its final destruction in 587 B.C., the temple itself, with its imposing complex of buildings, was still intact. And the elderly people who had seen it could still remember the remaining glory it had at that time. Haggai here asked the elderly people to compare the former splendor of this house with its present condition. It is important to note that the comparison does not concern two separate temples. In both cases, he's talking about the same structure. This is referring to one temple in two different conditions: the state it was in before its destruction and its present state after its destruction. One important point is that at this time the temple had not yet been rebuilt. So as they compare this temple to the old temple, they're really comparing one that had not been rebuilt to the old temple, that which was a finished structure. The work had hardly begun, and yet it had already been hindered by the discouragement of the people. The so-called second temple, which the people had been admonished to build, would only be completed 4 years later, Ezra 6:15. But the question was, how does it look to you now? There was hardly any comparison between the former state of the temple and the present state of the temple. Did it seem to you like nothing? The question suggests a positive answer. The question implies that the present state of the temple is very inferior to the former state of the temple. Now, you know, our bodies, our lives can become in the same way. We can find ourselves having slipped and fallen from those principles that we know, so that we're in a pretty miserable condition and we have to be rebuilt. We have to come back to the state that's a usable condition for God to use as His temple. The rebuilt temple that they were working on here in the time of Haggai would actually be larger than Solomon's temple, but the disappointment was rather due to the lack of suitable articles and the absence of certain articles such as the Ark of the Covenant. They realized that the new temple would never be like the old temple. They were not able to pay skilled craftsmen from other countries, as Solomon had done, and they could not begin to think of covering the interior with gold as we read of in 1 Kings 6, 21 and 22. In spite of the work already done, there seemed to be very little progress. The new temple, even with the proposed reconstruction, did not seem to be suitable for use by the Messiah, as promised by earlier prophets. So this unfavorable comparison of the present to the past discouraged their work on the temple. The people need to be encouraged again. In order to deal with this problem, Haggai's message has two features. One, the leaders and the people are encouraged to be strong and to take heart and to work, verse 4. And two, God himself will solve the problem of filling the temple, verses 5 through 9. So in verse 4 he says, "Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Josedek, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts." In the minds of the people, this rebuilt temple is not going to be near as glorious as the original temple. This was very disappointing, and it seemed to be a justifiable reason to even stop the rebuilding effort. It's easy to sympathize with the feeling of the people, but not Haggai. Haggai says, "Yet now." Haggai not only introduces a new thought, but prepares the way for a surprising and new approach toward the people's dilemma. He says, "Yet now be strong." The people are not given sympathy, but encouraged to be strong, encouraged to have courage. The phrase "be strong" refers to a frame of mind which enables one to pursue something with zeal and diligence. Leaders and people must be not discouraged, but must join hands and join forces in a united effort to rebuild the temple of the Lord. The responsibility of the leaders and the people individually and jointly is emphasized by the repetition of the command to be strong. This is encouraging all of them to act together. And the expression here in this verse, "all ye people of the land," refers to the community that has come out of captivity. It means the same as "all the remnant of the people," as we read of in chapter 1, verse 12. And it says, "and work." This is the only way any of us can obey the commands of God. It is some kind of action carried out by our individual bodies. It is the opposite of being lazy or slothful. It is a basic teaching throughout the Bible. He says, "For I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts." The encouragement given to the people and the leaders is enforced and founded in the promise that God will be with them. We have the same promise given us today in Matthew 26, 18 through 20, and Hebrews 13, 5 through 6, and we've read those passages earlier. And he says, "I'm with you, saith the Lord of hosts." This is the Lord of all power. This is the God that has all the power to do everything, anything. This is the creator of the universe. So when you have that power behind you, you've got all power. Verse 5 says, "According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you, fear ye not." Just as the Lord's spirit and word was with them when they came out of Egypt, even so he still has his spirit to be with them in this time of returning from Babylonian captivity. Just as God had made a covenant with them as they were led by Moses, even so at this time he says, "My spirit remaineth among you. Fear not." Fear is a condition which affects all humans from time to time. Fear is the feeling caused by the nearness of danger or of the possibility of something bad happening. This feeling is the root cause of anxiety and or depression. It is very common for humans to experience this feeling. But here God promises to be with them. Consequently, he says, "Fear not." He has a reason to tell them not to fear. He's going to be with them. He promised that his spirit will be with them. And that's why he says, "Fear not." No need to have the feeling caused by the nearness of danger. No need to have the feeling caused by the possibility of something bad happening. "I have a covenant with you," he says. "I'm with you. My spirit is with you. Just as I was with you when you came out of Egypt." And so we have the same power with us today. In Matthew 28, 18 through 20, "And Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." Amen. Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. "Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee, nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, The Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me." And so here in verse 5 he says, "Fear ye not." It is clear that the prophet is referring to the presence and power of God at the Exodus. And this is intended to be a continual promise during the time they're rebuilding the temple. Just as he helped them to come out of Egypt and across the Red Sea, he's going to help them to build the temple. So he says, "My spirit remaineth among you." Well, his spirit actually gave this prophecy. Certainly the spirit is among them. He says among you instead of with you. This indicates that the spirit will be with the group. Verse 4 says, "I am with you," which indicates more of a presence of God with each individual. But the spirit is among you. Verses 6 and 7 say, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts." Now, in these verses, God is here showing that this temple will be glorified. And he's showing how the temple will be glorified. The greatest glory of the temple will happen when they shall have the Messiah among them. He will be in the temple, and his presence will glorify it. He says the desire of all nations shall come. All prophets bore witness of the Messiah, and this prophet Haggai bears witness also of the Messiah here in verses 6 and 7. Here's an indirect reference to the fact that he is coming, implying that it should not be long before he comes. He says, "Yet once more, and it is a little while," verse 6, "and the desire of all nations shall come," verse 7. The Old Testament church has but one stage more to travel before he comes to this earth. Five stages are now passed. First of all, Adam to Noah. Secondly, Noah to Abraham. Thirdly, Abraham to Moses. Fourthly, Moses to Solomon's temple. Fifthly, Solomon's temple to the captivity. And sixthly, now one more stage, this sixth stage, and then comes the Messiah and his kingdom. The sixth stage was the return from captivity with the rebuilding of the temple. It would last until the coming of the Messiah and the establishing of his kingdom and the destruction of the temple, which was completed in AD 70. And now, today, we're in the last stage, the seventh stage, waiting for the second coming of Christ. When he comes again, may he find faith on the earth. Luke 18:8 says, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth." Let the children of promise continue to look for him. It is but a little time, and he shall come. Hebrews 10:37 says, "For he that shall come will come and will not tarry." And as he said then of his first appearance, so he says of his second appearance, "Surely I come quickly." And that's in Revelation 20, verse 7, verse 12, and verse 20. His first coming would be accomplished by a general shaking, verse 6. "I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land." This applies to the setting up of Christ's kingdom in the world, which was the establishing of his church. God promises here to do once again for his church, as he did when he brought them out of Egypt. He shook the heavens and the earth at Mount Sinai with thunder and lightning and earthquakes. He shook the sea and the dry land when the Red Sea was dried up and streams were made to come out of the rock. And this would be done again when, at the suffering of Christ, the sun would be darkened, the earth would shake, and the rocks would be torn apart. Matthew 27:50-54 say, "Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose, and came out of the graves after his resurrection, and went into this holy city, and appeared there to many. And with a centurion, and they that were with him, watching Jesus, saw the earthquake, and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, Truly, this was the Son of God." When at the birth of Christ, Herod and all Jerusalem were troubled, Matthew 2:32. In Luke 2:34 we read, "And Simeon blessed them, and said unto Mary his mother, Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against." When his kingdom was set up, it was with a shock to the nations. The philosophies of men were silenced, idols were destroyed, and the powers of the kingdom were moved and removed. Hebrews 12:27-29, "And this word yet once more signify the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, we receive a kingdom which cannot be moved. Let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire. So the shaking of the nations is often done so the church can be settled, and the things which cannot be shaken can be established. And so he says, the desire of all nations shall come. He shall be desirable to all nations. The Messiah was Abraham's seed. Genesis 12:3, and I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. They will be blessed with the best of blessings, long expected and desired by the good people of all nations. These would include those that had any misunderstanding of the Old Testament prophecies concerning him. Balaam in the land of Moab had spoken of a star that should arise out of Jacob. And Job in the land of Uz had spoken of his living Redeemer, Job 19:25. When devout men out of every nation of heaven were gathered at Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2, they were expecting to see the setting up of the kingdom of the Messiah at that time. All nations that have had Christ made known to them and are trained in his ways have called him and will call him all my salvation, all my desire, as David did in 2 Samuel 23:5. In Genesis 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Then he says, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The house they are now building will be filled with glory to such a degree that its glory shall exceed that of Solomon's temple. Whatever their enemies did to cast contempt on the house they were building would not diminish its glory when God filled it with glory when the Messiah was in it. The glory that comes from God is satisfying and is not vainglory. It is God's prerogative to fill the temple as it pleases him. Moses' tabernacle and Solomon's temple were filled with glory when God, in a cloud, took possession of them. But this house, this rebuilt temple, shall be filled with glory of another nature. To be in the physical presence of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is a glory we have not experienced in the flesh. But today, we do have his glory spiritually, and eventually we shall see him as he is. 1 John 3:2, Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Verse 8 says, the silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. They're not to be concerned because this house will not have as much silver and gold in it as Solomon's temple had. All the silver and gold in the world are God's. This includes all that is hid in the bowels of the earth. Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. All that is laid up in the banks, stocks and bonds, all the treasure of men, and all that is used for the maintenance of trade and commerce, it's all the Lord's. When gold and silver are dedicated to his honor and used in his service, it adds nothing to him, for it was all his before. When David and his princes offered vast amounts for the services of the house of God, they acknowledged, it is all thy own, and of thy own, Lord, have we given thee. 1 Chronicles 29:14-16. Therefore, God does not need sacrifice, for every beast of the forest is his. Psalm 50:10. However, if we have silver and gold, we must serve and honor God with them, for they are all his own, and we only have the use of them. But if we have not silver and gold to honor him with, we must honor him with such as we do have. And he will accept us, for he needs none of our material possessions. After all, he created all things. It is our heart and our love that he wants. John 14:15 says, if you love me, keep my commandments. And so he says in verse 9, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts, and in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. He's promising here that the glory of this latter house is going to be greater than the glory of the first house. But this was never true so far as outward glory goes. The latter house was much beautified and enriched by Herod, And we find the disciples admiring the stones and buildings of the temple, how fine they were. Mark 13:1, and as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples saith unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. But the scholars claim that it was nothing in comparison to the first temple. The Jews admit that several of the divine glories of the first temple were missing from the second temple. The Ark of the Covenant, manna from heaven, Aaron's rod that budded, fire from heaven, the Thummim and Urim. We cannot conceive how the glory of this latter house should in any way exceed the glory of the first, except that one glory which would indeed excel all the glories of the first house, that is the presence of the Messiah in it, the Son of God, who was the glory of his people Israel. He was in the temple at the age of 12. Later he preached there and worked miracles there. He drove the buyers and sellers out of it. It was necessary that the Messiah should come while the second temple stood, but that temple has long been destroyed since AD 70. Our bodies today are the temple of God. He is still the glory of the temple today, but this is our body instead of a building made of wood and stone. Without him, we have no glory. Without him, the church has no glory. He must be present for the church to even exist. The greatest, most grand structure built by man has no glory if it has not Christ. Yet the most humble person or group of persons who are following the will of God have more glory than any man-made structure. If he is present in us, we can reflect his glory. And we must believe that our Lord Jesus is the Christ, is the Messiah, and that he will come again, and we look for no other. His presence was the true glory of the latter house, the rebuilt temple, as well as the true glory of the church today. God's temple today, which is our bodies, is every bit as precious and important to us as that temple was to them in the time of Haggai. And the thing that would glorify that temple now glorifies our temple today. We close our lesson there. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends.